You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
His famous essay called Politics and the English Language, George Orwell wrote, "The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish squirting out ink." That was in 1946, but I think it's fair to say that George Orwell would have been troubled by many of the words and phrases that were added to the American lexicon this year, most of them courtesy of politicians and pundits. Since Mr. Orwell is no longer available, we have invited Ben Zimmer, the online columnist for the New York Times Magazine and a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary, to assess the worst of the latest crop. Hi. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Another quotation from George Orwell sums up the nature of political language, which he argues is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. Does that more or less sum up some of the words that were used by politicians this year?
I think Orwell was onto something there in terms of the way that politicians use what we would now call spin. That wasn't something that that Orwell would have talked about, but he was certainly similar in terms of the way that politicians will take a topic and either try to cast it in a very positive light by using a euphemism or something else that sounds innocuous, or they go the other way to paint the opponent's policies or views as terrible. And, the messaging people in both sides try to pick up on this. I think it's recognize that the Republicans tend to be more successful in this kind of what's often called framing of issues to their advantage, but we do see that on both sides of the political spectrum.
Was it John Kyle who said that this lame duck Congress is anti-Christian because, or anti-Christmas, because people are being forced to stay there instead of being able to go home and prepare for the holidays? That's the sort of thing you're talking about, isn't it?
That's a rhetorical move, but that you can make where you're obviously trying to paint your opponents in the worst possible light. That kind of
A Jim DeMint, I can't remember.
Yeah, but it's something where sometimes just a catchphrase will do the trick. Last year, for instance, famously the line that Sarah Palin was using during the debates about the public option and so forth, where she was talking about death panels. That's a good example of what linguists would call a dysphemism, which is the opposite of a euphemism. So dysphemism for taking something ostensibly neutral and painting it in a very negative light. And we saw lots of examples of that this year as well.
Death tax instead of estate tax.
Yeah, that's an example. Frank Luntz is the great Republican messaging guru who makes sure that the Republicans can sort of get on the same page with the use of certain things like death tax for estate tax. But of course, it works the other way too when you're trying to paint what you like in the best possible light. So, say you want to make proposals for oil drilling. Well, you can call that energy exploration, and it sounds a lot better that way.
Not all the words that come into common usage are bad words. You're on the Executive Council of the American Dialect Society, which will be holding its conference between January 6th and 8th in Pittsburgh. Isn't that where the word of the year is generally selected?
That's right. Every year we select the word of the year. Been doing it for – this is going to be the 21st year that American Dialect Society has done it. So it's really the granddaddy of all the word of the year selections. Since then, a lot of other folks have stepped up with their own word of the year announcements as well. This is generally considered the most prestigious one, but at the same time, it's a very lighthearted moment for a group that's usually involved in various serious-minded discussions about the diversity of language in the United States. And so it's actually just a sort of a fun moment for everyone to participate in. We also, I should mention, accept nominations from the public. If you go to americandialect.org, the website for the American Dialect Society, you can get all the information about how to submit your own nominations for Word of the Year.
Well, those are really zeitgeist words, aren't they? Last year's was tweet, and the year before was bailout.
Yeah.
Words that kind of describe where the country is going. Did you vote for those words?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember last year, I you know, tweet seemed like a pretty obvious choice. I was fine with it. I think I was pushing for another word. I was very interested in the development of the word fail, which really came into its own last year, not just as a verb, but as a noun or an interjection where you could just say fail or refer to something as a fail. And so I thought that was a very interesting development last year. But tweet went out, and tweet's a perfectly good choice, and we can see obviously it's become even more successful this past year.
Fail, a verb becoming a noun?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that you see starting online a lot. In 2009, it came into prominence thanks to Twitter because of things like CNN fail, where people were critiquing CNN's coverage of the protests in Iran after the elections there, or Amazon fail, or you could refer to something as an epic fail, where, you know, it's more than just a failure. It's a really egregious type of falling down by somebody that you can easily ridicule.
We're focusing today on the worst words of the year, and later in the segment we'll be taking calls from our listeners with their nominations for the worst words of 2010. Our number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So we looked at your list of top words of 2010. You put them into six categories: politics, the economy, popular culture, the environment, technology. And a topic of special interest this past year, airport security.
Yes, lots of words about airport security this year, at least the last few months of the year.
So one of the words is cable gate, and I wonder about this. Doesn't every year bring another gate word? How long ago was Watergate, and when do you think we can retire the gate?
It doesn't seem like that gate ending for a political scandal, or really any type of scandal, is going away anytime soon, and we can see that pretty much immediately when these diplomatic cables were released by WikiLeaks, this, you know, dump of 250,000 secret diplomatic cables. Almost immediately, people were, again, taking to Twitter or other social media and calling it Cablegate, using that as a hashtag, which is another word that's sort of come into its own in the last couple of years, where you identify the subject of what you're talking about on a Twitter update, a tweet, to make it easier for other people to follow that particular topic. People were using Cablegate right away as the hashtag to refer to this big brewing scandal. It certainly fits, I think, in the case of something like this, where it's a major scandal with geopolitical consequences. But sometimes gate gets used for even just the smallest little things. Last time I was on your show, we were talking about the word that Sarah Palin concocted, refudiate. Well, that got to be such a tempest in a teapot that people were actually talking about refudiate gate.
Well, let's talk about another thing that she coined. She seems to coin a lot of memorable phrases and words. Mama Grizzly, we have a clip for that one.
There in Alaska, I always think of the Mama Grizzly bears that rise up on their hind legs when somebody's coming to attack their cubs, to do something adverse toward their cubs. No, the Mama Grizzlies, they rear up. And, you know, if you thought pit bulls were tough, well, you don't want to mess with the Mama Grizzlies.
Now, if somebody else had come up with that phrase, you think anybody would have paid much attention?
Probably not. Sarah Palin definitely has a knack for this sort of thing. You could hear from that clip, which I believe was released in July as a video from her political action committee. She was calling back. She was recalling her line about pit bulls from 2008, where she made the joke in the speech at the Republican National Convention. What's the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull lipstick? Mm-hmm. And so she seems to like these sort of animal metaphors. When she resigned as governor of Alaska, she used the line, "Only dead fish swim downstream," I think was the line. And so she uses these folksy, homey metaphors that might reflect something about Alaska, certainly in the case of Mama Grizzly. And she used it as a way of referring to these conservative women who were running in the midterm elections and giving a catchy label for them. So she definitely has a knack for coming up with those sorts of labels.
And one of those Mama Grizzlies came up with a phrase. I don't know if she invented the phrase, man up.
Oh, no, she didn't invent it. I mean, you're talking about Sharon Angle, who ran against Harry Reid for Senate in Nevada unsuccessfully, as it turned out. She just used it in a very prominent way. I actually wrote in the On Language column for the New York Times in September about how I had noticed Man Up was being used, this kind of exhortation to either, you know, be either macho or just be responsible in some way. And it was showing up everywhere in pop culture. You hear it on beer commercials and so forth. And then come October, it started showing up in politics in a very prominent way, most notably with Sharon Angle saying this to Harry Reid. And some people really took offense to that and interpreted this as a kind of a challenge to Harry Reid's masculinity. And they also noted the kind of gender imbalance with such a term where you can't just come back at Sharon Angle and say, woman up. That obviously doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Or be more feminine or something like that.
Right. I mean, it seems like she was appropriating the language of alpha males to take this on in a way. And there were other female candidates, I believe, Robin Carnahan, who's running in Nebraska, who was a Democrat. So it wasn't just a strictly one-party thing, this use of man up.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, the executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus, editor of the online magazine, also the online language columnist for the New York Times Magazine, a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary, and we're talking about some of the memorable, mostly ugly words of the last year. And we invite your calls and suggestions at 646-829-3985, or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Some of the words that became prominent are not all that unique, but I guess it's because of the situation that they become, that they stand out, like shellacking.
Right. I mean, President Obama memorably used this term in his press conference after the midterm elections, when the Democrats obviously did quite poorly. And it's funny because 4 years before that, George W. Bush had the occasion to talk about how Republicans fared poorly in the midterm elections, and he called it a thumping. So Obama used another colorful term, shellacking, which actually goes all the way back to the 1920s as a bit of American slang to get shellacked, actually, you know, taking this term that actually referred to a kind of varnish, or, you know, something you would use to varnish floors. And originally to get shellacked meant you getting drunk, like getting plastered. The flappers of the 20s would use that. But then it started getting used in sports like boxing, where you talk about a boxer taking a shellacking. So perhaps he was in such a stupor that he could hardly move, as if he was covered in shellac. Mm-hmm. And then it made the transition into things like politics. And so just the fact that President Obama used this very colorful word in such a public way to talk about the Democrats' defeat made it a notable word of the year.
The only reason it doesn't get used more is because I suspect headline writers don't like a word that's that long.
That could be. Although, you know, when I was doing some research on it, I noticed that baseball stories back in the, you know, the 20s and 30s would often talk about, you know, the Yankees shellac the Red Sox. It was one of those colorful terms that headline writers liked for baseball.
We'll take a little break and come back with more of the words of 2010, some of them okay, some of them rather difficult to explain, some of them really ugly, with my guest Ben Zimmer, who is the on-language columnist for the New York Times Magazine and a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary. Stay with us. We're back with Ben Zimmer, who does a lot of different things connected to the language. The reason most of us know him is because he has the On Language column in the New York Times Magazine, the column that William Safire used to have. He does it in perhaps a less political way. And we are taking your calls at 646-829-3985 for your nominations for some of the worst words of the year. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And some people are also leaving some suggestions on our Facebook page. Let me go through a few of those. Eric on our show page says, wheelhouse. I never heard this word used before the last few months. Now some of the more verbose friends and pop culture pundits in the media have started using the word to describe it, an example of something belonging to a person's purview or area of knowledge.
Yeah, that's one I believe is comes over from sports, from baseball, for instance. You can talk about a pitch being in a batter's wheelhouse. And so that gets extended as a metaphor, too, for people saying, oh, that, you know, that question or that, you know, whatever was really in my wheelhouse. So it's interesting. I don't think that's particularly new. Very often we'll notice something, assume that it's new, and then we start hearing it a lot just because we're paying attention to it and identify it as a trend. But if you actually look and see how people have been using it over time, these things that might appear recent to us might not actually be so recent. They can actually have some history to them.
We did ask listeners on Facebook to share their latest favorite words. Sarah Jane told us it was totes as a substitute for totally. Emma said it's Google as a verb. And John said it's staycay for vacation or not going on vacation. David said it's spot on, which he hears a lot these days. Now, spot on has been around a long time, hasn't it?
I think so. Perhaps that's something that was more common in British English and might be becoming more popular in American English. That's always a possibility. What's interesting about these words that are being brought up by listeners and readers is that people could have very, very different reactions to words. So abbreviating totally as totes, you know, a lot of people might like that. It's a catchy little thing, an abbreviation of totally. While it might really get under other people's skin, or, you know, staycay as a form for staycation on the model of vacation getting shortened to vacay. You know, again, these are things that for some people might just seem a little too cute and grating, possibly, but others might just revel in these new forms of the language.
Jordan suggests idiate. Now, that's not a new one either, is it?
No, certainly not. That's an old word. I'm sure you could sort of dig into that, the use of that word for centuries. But what might be newer is ideate, as most people pronounce it, to be used in a business context. That's a kind of management speak that might rub people the wrong way.
So it's like brainstorming.
Exactly.
Although brainstorm probably sounded strange when it was coined.
That's very true. That's true. So brainstorming was probably a flashy new bit of management speak at one time. And now perhaps because we're always looking for something new to identify the same old stuff, we use a word like ideate or ideation to refer to it.
Andrea from Philadelphia says on our show page, Obamacare. I always envision the president in a white coat asking me to say ah. And obviously it's an attempt to get people to ignore the actual provisions of health care reform and envision a kind of fascistic, brave new world scenario.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the sort of Orwellian things that we were talking about before at the top of the program, where the political spin that's put on language, very often what's most effective is this type of branding where you personalize it. So talking about Obamacare and making it seem like this is strictly something that Obama is trying to foist on the American public was a popular word that was used and really harked back to back in the Clinton administration when opponents of the health care proposal that Hillary Clinton was front and center in proposing, they called that Hillary Care. So identifying that program with Hillary and now the new program with Obama has served as a very effective linguistic weapon for the opponents of these programs.
The economy has been the source of any number of new words. 99er. Fat finger error. I like that one. What is a fat finger? And, well, 99er is the people who were on unemployment insurance extended to 99 weeks.
Yeah. Now, that's a case where we know that this is a brand new word for this year because this is a new thing when they extended unemployment insurance to 99 weeks. And the people who go beyond that started to be called 99ers this year, using that ER ending that we see in lots of other things like the birthers, the truthers, and so forth. They're all sorts of the uses of that ER ending these days. The other one you mentioned, fat finger error, that showed up back when in May, people might remember there was this mysterious dip of 1,000 points in the Dow Jones just instantaneously. It went down 1,000 points. People were trying to figure out what this flash crash was all about. And the initial blame was on a fat finger error, which is this term that traders use when you just slip and you hit the wrong key, and maybe you put in billion when you meant million, and all of a sudden you have a fat finger error. Another interesting term out of sort of tech speak for this type of error is thumbo. We all know about typos, and there's also people have also talked about speakos as sort of a spoken equivalent, while a thumbo is when your thumb is just a little too big and hits the wrong key.
One of the other ones that I really like, I don't know if I like it, but I think that it will be with us for a while, is robo-signing.
Yeah, that was another interesting development this year because of the foreclosure scandal, particularly in Florida, where there are these companies doing these rather shady practices. They were calling them foreclosure mills. Where they were, doing lots and lots of foreclosures, getting them processed really quickly, basically by having bank officials approve the documents without actually looking at them. And so the controversial practice, they called that robo-signing.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, who writes the On Language column for the New York Times Magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I want to play something from Lou Dobbs, a phrase that you didn't include in your list.
So here's the basic issue here. People coming into the country to have a child, that child will be legal, and then it will ultimately make them legal as well, right?
Right. Well, it's certainly, there's even a term for it called anchor babies.
Sure.
He didn't invent anchor baby, did he? Is that the reason that he was fired? I would have fired him for that.
I don't think that was the particular reason for him leaving CNN, but certainly the anti-immigration talk this year had a lot of very inflammatory terms. Anchor baby was one of them. Even more inflammatory than anchor baby, we heard terror baby, which was sort of taking things to the real extreme and imagining that terrorists would come and have children on American soil so that they could raise a citizen, that their children could become citizens and then grow up to become terrorists from within the inside. So a lot of fear-mongering that was going on around that issue. We saw other issues, too, where there was a lot of fear-mongering. We all recall the debate about the Islamic Cultural Center near the Ground Zero site. And so a term like Victory Mosque, which I believe even Newt Gingrich used, referring to that as somehow that allowing this to be built a couple of blocks away from the Ground Zero site would represent a victory for Islamic terrorism.
Well, I've been concerned about it myself, and I saw a man selling halal gyros right near the Ground Zero site, and I asked him to show a little respect and move two blocks south. Another phrase that you didn't include, but I think that's fun, is Aqua Buddha.
Aqua Buddha. You know, we had all sorts of very colorful stuff going on in the—
This is a good year.
There were some fantastic races going on in the country, and Aqua Buddha was the deity that came up in the— Rand Paul's the story came out about some collegiate shenanigans that went on where he made someone bow and pray to the Aqua Buddha, and that became something that was used by his opponent in debates as a way to perhaps make it seem like he might not be the most Christian fellow. And of course, Rand Paul took offense to that. Another great one from one of the elections was Demon Sheep. I don't know if you remember that commercial from Carly Fiorina out in California. That there was a commercial that was widely ridiculed, where she painted her opponent as a wolf in sheep's clothing, and so among people sort of watching all of this, Demon Sheep became an instant punchline.
There are a whole bunch of pop culture words: Belieber, Gleek, GTL.
Right. Well,
but if you don't watch the shows, you don't know what they mean.
This is a problem. This is true. They might have very specific audiences, and so the enthusiastic fans of Justin Bieber, the teen pop sensation, call themselves Beliebers. The fans of the TV show Glee call themselves Gleeks, which combines Glee with Geek, where geek is now being used as a positive term. It's not so negative as it used to be. And GTL, for fans of the MTV reality show Jersey Shore, will know that that's the daily mantra of the stars of that show: gym, tan, laundry.
There were a whole bunch of different phrases that came out of the BPL spill. You included static kill, but you could probably have come up with four or five different ones.
It's true. You know, it's interesting. It's perhaps because the BP spill happened earlier in the year, it's not as fresh in our memory as opposed to, say, something like the backlash against the TSA pat-down procedures. We've forgotten a bit that there were all sorts of terms that were coming out of the oil spill, some having to do with the crazy techniques that BP was trying to use to solve the problem. We had the junk shot. We had the top hat. And all sorts of things. The top kill. Eventually, so the static kill was the one that actually did the trick. But there were all sorts of other terms that people were coming up at the time to ridicule BP and their attempts to solve that massive problem in the Gulf.
Well, your mention of the airport pat down procedures reminds us that we have a really interesting clip to play.
They're going to be doing a standard pat down on you today, using my hands going like this on your body. Also, we're going to be doing a groin check. That means I'm going to place my hand on your hip, the other hand on your inner thigh, slowly go up and slide down.
Okay.
You're going to do that two times in the front and two times in the back.
All right.
And if you'd like a private screening, we can make that available for you also.
We could do that out here, but if you touch my junk, I'm going to have you arrested.
And that became a popular phrase. You touch my junk, I'll have you arrested.
Or just shortened to "Don't touch my junk." That became a slogan, really, rallying people who had a problem with these new pat down procedures. And I mentioned the junk shot that occurred in the Gulf of Mexico with BP trying to put all sorts of crazy stuff like rope and tennis balls into the blowout preventer. And then and then in November we have the "Don't touch my junk" line from this young software programmer who managed to catch all of this on his phone so that he could then broadcast the video of it online. And within about 48 hours of him putting that online, "Don't touch my junk" became this catchphrase. And I think because of that, actually junk, despite being this very sophomoric word to refer to someone's private parts, actually has a lot going for it to be possibly word of the year.
Well, there's also another version. It's called the Freedom Pat.
The Freedom Pat, yeah. I mean, that's another way that we see that people are really taking satire to new heights this year and using the media, like social media like Twitter, in order to accomplish that. So Freedom Pat was a funny term as a kind of a fake euphemism that showed up on a fake Twitter account called TSAGov. When there's something goes on like the BP oil spill or this TSA thing, people now will create fake accounts that make it seem as if they're important public officials, but really they're just making fun of those officials. And so on that fake Twitter account, they said, well, it's not a grope, it's a freedom pat. And a lot of people played with that and came up with other terms along those lines.
I wondered about that when I was on a line waiting to pay a cashier, and they said, "Next client, please," instead of "next customer." Or "next," which would have been perfectly. we're coming up with euphemisms for everything. There are recycling is now repurposing. Why? What's wrong with recycling?
You know, the way that we treat these words, sometimes a word that seemed perfectly fine before, over time, people might feel the need to present it in a new light. And so perhaps customer was fine before, and now client is a way for a company to make those customers feel more important. You know, very often, again, it's a way of taking a kind of a social interaction and trying to provide some sort of lubrication for the process and using nice words. But sometimes those nice words can really get under our skin because they really seem to be going too far in that direction.
Well, I'm sure every customer at Target appreciates being called a client. Michael from Manhattan, you had a thought about this. Michael?
Yes, hello, am I on?
Yes.
Yeah, hi, Leonard. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy your show. What's interesting to me is the use of the word "gay" these days, because here is a word, and I'm not coming from a PC place, but a proper use of the word that formerly was an adjective, a descriptive word, and now it's taken on the form of a noun.
But gay goes back a while now, at least 20 years.
Yeah, but to hear like the gays in high school or the gays in college or the gays in the military or whatever. I'm an openly gay man myself, so it's not, you know, it's not an issue with that, but it just always felt weird or sound weird. Like you wouldn't say the blacks in the military or the blacks in this segment mm-hmm. of society. So just to hear an adjective take on the form of a noun, is that something new or is that been around?
I wouldn't say it's new. You know, as Leonard mentioned, I mean, both the adjective and noun for homosexuals has become pretty entrenched over the last couple of decades. But the reaction to its use as, for instance, the gays in the military is an interesting one because we see that happen with, in other cases, the caller mentioned the blacks. We could also talk about the use of Jew as a noun, for instance, where sometimes people would prefer to use the adjective Jewish to talk about Jewish people rather than Jews. And so talking about gays in this manner, while it might be easy, again, in sort of a soundbite or a headline to talk about gays in the military, for instance, for people on the receiving end of that, it might sound a bit blunt in the same way that Jews sounds blunter than referring to Jewish people.
We're also starting to see, I remember years ago, Gone with the Wind was always GWTW. Now we have DADT, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I hardly ever see it as Don't Ask, Don't Tell anymore, just DADT.
When something like that, a policy is getting in the headlines so much, obviously we look for ways to shorten it. I certainly think that Twitter has been an important force lately in people looking for abbreviations and shorter ways to say things just to fit in that 140-character space.
Ben Zimmer is executive producer of The Visual Thesaurus, editor of the online magazine, and also the on-language columnist for the New York Times Magazine and a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary. And we've been talking about some of the new words or the newly popularized words of the past year. And we thank you all for contributing. And we thank Ben Zimmer for being on our show today. Ben, it's always a lot of fun. Or I guess it's – what is the – how do we say fun these days?
You might say it's not just fun, but it's funner and funnest. That's funner one that funnest. Will always get under people's skin.